All right, let's get on with this. Let's do this thing.
Okay.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul, how you doing? You feeling good today?
I am feeling pretty good.
I feel like you might have been on cloud nine for the past couple of weeks. Did you have a big game recently? Anything interesting in your life that might have caused you some joy?
Yes. The Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl. And not only did they win the Super Bowl, they beat the Patriots, which makes it all the sweeter.
Yes.
Yes, so in case anyone knows, I grew up in Philadelphia, so I did not know what it was like to have your team win the Super Bowl. It's a very neat
game. I know. Yeah. It's we're all very proud of you, particularly my fellow Steelers fans who we have six.
Yeah, so rub that in. Yeah.
So congratulations, you're on your way, fellow Pennsylvanian.
Yes, I only need five more to match you.
But I don't for the record, neither of us currently live in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yes, yes. But I don't think the city of Philadelphia will remain standing if two more of these happen. I'm surprised.
I don't know. You guys were pretty well behaved.
By Philadelphia standards, I think so, yes.
By Philadelphia standards, sure.
Right. Well, today on the program, we'll be discussing the classic 1989 Elseworlds story, Gotham by Gaslight, the Victorian-era Batman adventure by Brian Augustin and Mike Mignola. But first, there's a couple of things going on around the world of comics that I'd like to talk about. The first being, it has been announced, well, not announced, but it should say rumored that Michael Bay is on board to do a film version of Lobo. What do you think about that news, Brian?
Well, I imagine there will be a lot of explosions. the dialogue and acting will be very poor, and there will be no plot.
Yes, my feelings exactly. To be fair, Michael Bay does do spectacle very well. However,
does he?
He does do spectacle very well. However, substance tends to elude him from time to time.
He does spectacle very well. I would quibble with very well.
No, he's a very visually unique filmmaker. I don't like him. I'm not saying that at all, but I'm trying to give him, some
credit. Paul Carr defending Michael Bay.
No. No,
that will be
not.
The headline that everybody takes from this tomorrow. And I'm actually going to insert it throughout our conversation today that you love Michael Bay. Because if you say it often enough, it makes it true.
Oh, wow. but first, I guess the major thing you need to ask yourself about this news is, who is it exactly that's screaming for a Lobo movie to be made?
Yes.
I mean, he was
agreed.
He had some popularity way back when, but he's just a marginal character at best.
Yeah, and a one-note character. While there, 20 plus years ago or so, maybe longer, I guess you could have said that he was DC's Deadpool. Like, not Deadpool at the time, but what DC is trying to do with Deadpool now, in terms of making a marginal character somehow interesting.
So that was my feeling as well. I think that Warner Brothers and DC want Lobo to be their version of Deadpool.
Right.
And
which had been the case back in, I call it the Wolverine factor.
Well, yeah. He was definitely the parody of Wolverine. I mean, there's that one point where he can regenerate himself from a drop of blood.
Yes.
And I get that from in the 90s at the time, it was kind of funny. It worked for what it was, but really, that's it. He was a parody that worked, for a very short period of time.
Right.
And it's very much of its time. Ever since then, he's really hit or miss, and mostly miss.
They've been trying to utilize him. I think he's in Justice League of America right now. Steve Orlando's run has been using him to some effect, but not as a, the entire comics community stops to see what, Lobo is up to in the latest issue of Justice League of America. So,
yeah.
I mean, if any director was going to do a Lobo film, I guess maybe it would be Michael Bay.
Yeah, it'll be Deadpool, but gritty with lots of explosions and no funny jokes.
And yeah, lots and lots and lots of explosions. And, you know, because we've never seen explosions in films before. So it's always really exciting in like a Transformers Part 68 when you're surprised that there might be an explosion that looks like an explosion in Transformers number 36. So.
Yeah, so both of us really aren't excited for this.
But let me tell you how I really feel about Michael Bay productions.
Well, Michael Bay aside, I mean, there's no point in doing a Lobo story because,
No,
you know, if you play the character straight, it's just a joke. But if you play him as a joke, he really doesn't have enough substance to sustain anything more than one joke. He's a one-hit wonder, basically.
Yeah. Well, he says Bastich a lot.
Yeah, because that's timely.
Yeah. Hilarious. Come on, Paul. Every time he says it, it's our laugh riot.
All right, but overall, let's face it. This is not going to happen. This
Do
is just DC talking
we
about
even know? Have they even talked casting?
it. No. It's not going to happen. DC just keeps throwing stuff out there. Their movie side of things, I don't know what the hell's happening. Because comic books, their comic book side, going really well right now. You know, they're knocking it out of the park over and over and over again.
Right.
But the film side of things is just,
It's
whew.
not great.
Yeah. Which brings us to the next subject, which is Joaquin Phoenix is apparently in talks to play the Joker in the mythical Martin Scorsese produced Joker origin movie. First, yeah, because you know what was really needed with the Joker was an origin story. That's what's been missing.
Oh, it's you know what? I don't want a Joker origin story. I think we've even covered this at some point in one of our past conversations. I don't want a Joker story or origin. I don't, you know. But at the end of the day, I'm a fanboy, and people in charge can make whatever decisions they want. That's fine. And you know, there's probably an audience out there that is like, you know, oh, I would, you know, what is missing in my life is a Joker origin story. It is not missing, and it is missing in my life, but I'm not missing it. And I like leaving it alone. You know, it's one of my few quibbles with Gotham, which the TV series, which I actually find to be vastly entertaining, which is not to say I think it's good, but I find it to be vastly entertaining. But one of my quibbles is that they're trying to give us, you know, a Joker origin in that TV show as well. And I'm like, I don't need it. There's a lot going on with Joker that I think is some interesting concepts, and a lot of writers have addressed different aspects of Joker while leaving the mystery be, as it were, that I find intriguing. And also, if you don't give him an origin story, then it allows for more creativity in presentation of him.
Yeah, he's a much more intriguing character if we don't know anything about him.
Right.
And I don't get, I mean, just to your point about Gotham, and you know, I'm not going to say anything bad about Gotham because I actually haven't seen it. But there's this trend now where people want to make TV shows and movies about what it's like in a place before the superhero gets there.
Right.
And I don't understand that. I mean, because there's going to be a new Krypton TV show, and there's going to be a
Yeah.
new what is this, Lex Luthor and Lois Lane solving crimes together?
Pardon me?
Yeah, that's a thing that's going to happen. It's Superman
Well,
before
heavens to
Superman.
Betsy, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's like going to be called Metropolis or something like that. So it's going to be Lex Luthor and Lois Lane solving crimes together. I guess,
Oh,
you know,
I
some kind of
don't know,
bizarre
Paul.
Remington Steele type of thing.
I could, I think, you know, I in concept, I might be able to get behind that.
Oh, but no, the whole
It depends on how much fun they have with it. You know, it's like, is it going to be played straight?
Look,
Or, you know.
Smallville did 10 seasons of No Superman. We don't need that anymore. Just do a Superman show.
Well,
Supergirl is good. Do a
some people
Superman show.
appreciated some people appreciated Smallville like No Superman because it went 10 seasons.
Just give us a just do the superhero show.
It doesn't really bother, you know, in the same way that I like the Gotham Centrals of the world or what have you. I like, you know, why not? It's certainly different. God bless the CW. And I actually like most of those superhero shows on the CW, but you know,
No, it, you know what?
they have plenty of superheroes as superhero shows. If they wanted to throw out a you know, common man or the view of superheroes from lots of writers have done this. Kurt Busiek has done it, particularly through Astro City and what was it, Marvels, I think. This is a thing that has been done in comics and film for a while, is, you know, the person on the streets account of superheroics. And while it's been done before, if you could do it well or do it with an interesting take, well, why not? So Lex Luthor and Lois Lane solving crimes, you know, are they going to call it LLLL? Did I get the right amount of L's in there? LLLL, yeah.
Or just the LOL.
The LOLs.
But LOLs at that point, why not try to create a new property? Something entirely new and exciting instead of taking characters out of context.
Paul, TV doesn't create new things.
It could. It used to.
We just recycle the same. We've got Will and Grace is back, Paul. Roseanne's coming back. The Office is coming back. Dynasty is on TV.
Well, Full House is back.
Full House is back.
Because people needed that.
It's television is, I shouldn't say it's bankrupt, because there are channels, there are stations out there that are actually doing new, interesting things. But, you know, even one of my favorite TV shows of the past several years has been Fargo, which, of course, mm-hmm. is, you know, based on the movie, although based is a rather loose term there.
Well, I mean, MASH was based on the movie.
Right.
But it went in completely different directions. But to get to reel us back again. into the Joaquin Phoenix thing.
Out of film criticism or out of television criticism, which we've only just scratched the surface of.
Yeah. That was my fault. I took us in that direction, but I'm trying to bring us back. So Joaquin Phoenix, everything about the Joker origin thing aside, the idea of him playing the Joker, I think that's an interesting idea. I mean, he's a compelling actor, and his take on the Joker would be, I think, worth seeing.
Joaquin Phoenix is a fine, very good actor. I have a great deal of appreciation for him. I think his performance in The Master, the year that came out, was mm-hmm. probably the real best performance of the year. I forget who he lost to, but it was some flashy role, I imagine. But how many iterations of the Joker do we need in film? I realized that a few minutes ago, I was just arguing for writers to go crazy with a variety of iterations of the Joker. And now I'm coming back and contradicting myself when it comes to film or television.
Well, that's what we do. We're podcasters.
Yes. But, you know, partly because I think a writer can do so much more, particularly in the medium of comics, because comics is a written and visual medium. Mm-hmm. Film is reliant on actors in a very sort of, it has to be a very steady interpretation if it's going to like carry through a film or a television series. And I mean, you know, Cesar Romero, Jack Nicholson, Heath Ledger, Jared Leto. I'm missing.
We should not speak of the Leto.
we will not speak of Leto. Yeah.
But you know, the Joker is something that people can do very unique things with. So if nothing else, I think Joaquin Phoenix could be a glorious failure that we could talk about for years and years and years.
I mean, it's interesting that Scorsese's name is attached to it. He's not attached as director. Am I correct on that?
That is correct. He's just producing it. The director is someone that I'm blanking on that not filling me with confidence.
But it is specifically to be an origin story?
Yes.
Which doesn't make sense either, because Joaquin Phoenix is what, in his 30s, 40s?
Well, this is supposed to be a one-shot unrelated to the DC Extended Universe.
Oh, so it's Joker removed from anything that makes the Joker Joker.
Right. So it's, so it's supposed to be...
A great idea.
My understanding of it, it's supposed to be an origin story that takes place in the 80s, and it's supposed to be like a Goodfellas King of Comedy type of thing.
Oh, for...
I'm not sure if it's supposed to be a prequel to the, or lead up to the Burton movies, or if it's just its own thing. I don't know. But overall, you know, taking a step back, I actually do think that the DC movie universe should do one-shot films, like tell complete unconnected stories unrelated to the greater movie franchise.
Oh, sure. I think that would be very, sure.
Yeah, right. I think that once they get the characters, you know, established in their own films and they've built back some faith. You know, faith has been restored to the cinematic world. Then they can start weaving in together into an interconnected universe if they want to do it that way. Mm-hmm. But right now, I mean, just jumping in with what they've done so far in the Snyderverse hasn't really worked, with one exception.
Well, I think probably seen the end of Snyderverse as well. So it'll be interesting to see what they do going forward. You know, I hope it's not a hard reboot like the... How many reboots of Spider-Man have we had just over the past 15 years? I mean... How many times can we retell the Spider-Man origin over and over and over again in film? But
to be fair, the Marvel version of that, they didn't do Uncle Ben, and they didn't do that. They just sort of threw him in there. Spider-Man is Spider-Man. Everyone knows who he is. And they just started the story with him already established. So that was actually a pretty good thing.
And I'm sure we're going to get another Superman origin film at some point within the near future, because that's something that folks are clamoring for as well.
Yeah, well, you know what? Let's see Batman's origin story, because I haven't seen Martha Martha Wayne shot and her pearls falling in quite a while.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you're contractually obligated to do that at the beginning of every Batman miniseries, possibly every Batman Elseworld story as well.
Yes, we are going to mention that here today. But overall, this whole Joaquin Phoenix thing, let's face it, it's not going to happen. Much like the Lobo movie, it's just people throwing stuff at the wall to see if it sticks.
Well, excellent. So we have discussed two things.
That will never happen.
Thank goodness we didn't talk about the Bendis writing an X-Men movie.
You mentioned that before, you know, off air, before we started recording. I haven't heard anything about that. So is that
I am not presenting that as news. I was merely presenting that as there are a couple little voices whispering about this being a thing. We are not breaking news here. This is not news. Possibly a thing that isn't even real. But there have been a couple whispers about that, which, you know, I'm just leaving it at that. I was merely pointing out these two films are probably as likely to happen as this other rumored thing.
Okay, so this just in, Brian Rees breaking the story that Brian Michael Bendis will be writing an X-Men film. Yes, I'm a big fan of Michael Bay.
And Paul loves Michael Bay. So we are now, we've broken news twice now.
Yes, we've broken something.
Something is terribly, terribly broken.
Yes. And on that note, why don't we take a quick break and come back with some Victorian Batman?
That sounds lovely, Paul.
Do you love comics? Do you love overanalyzing your favorite characters and stories? Then welcome to NerdSync, your new favorite place on the internet. Each week, we encourage a deeper look at comics for newcomers and experts alike, exploring things like psychology, culture, art, science, and more through the amazing world of superheroes. If you've ever wondered how Daredevil's radar sense works, or whether or not Batman actually remembers the night his parents died, or simply why Lex Luthor is bald, then you should consider joining the best community of comic book fans on the internet by hitting that big sexy subscribe button. We believe that asking questions and overthinking things and examining comics beyond the surface can actually enrich your comic book reading experience and allow you to see comics as even more awesome than they already are. So check out some of our videos below and don't forget to subscribe. It's free and it makes sure that you never miss a thing. I'm Scott and let's start talking about comics.
And we're back. Now, before I begin my synopsis, I want to first acknowledge the fact that in the trade of this story, the collected edition, there is an additional story called Master of the Future, which is a sequel to this main story we're going to talk about. And we are not going to talk about that sequel. We wanted to just focus on the main storyline, but I just wanted to mention it in case there are some purists out there who might take exception to the fact that we're leaving it out. So I just want to say I'm sorry, but frankly, we have a hard enough time focusing on one story. God forbid we have to do two.
And to be fair, it's probably my fault because I was just reading the individual comic and didn't know that the collected edition had an additional story in it.
Okay, I was going to leave that out.
That's fine. But I'm good with that. I'm old school.
Yeah, you are. You're Mr. Floppy.
Yes. That's and you love Michael Bay.
So here we go. Gotham by Gaslight is a one-shot Elseworld Batman comic from 1989, written by Brian Augustin, with art by Mike Mignola. An Elseworld story is, of course, an alternate version of a character not set in the main continuity. This can involve alternate realities, timelines, or time periods. In this way, a character could be explored in radically different ways, allowing the writer and artist to experiment and innovate on the character and his or her setting. In this story, we find Batman, with a hyphen, and his alter ego, Bruce Wayne, living in 1889 at the height of the Victorian age. Now, at the time this story was written, 1989, steampunk, the idea of an alternate history and technology set in the 19th century, had just been christened and was really beginning to take off as a subgenre. So this type of setting for a Batman story was both new and very much of its time. As the story opens, Bruce Wayne is returning from 5 years in Europe, where he spent time learning new techniques in crime detection, psychology, and fighting styles. On the boat home, he runs into an old family friend, Jacob Parker, also returning from a long time abroad. And once back in Gotham, Bruce begins to reacquaint himself with old friends and the city that seems to have grown since he was gone. In addition, Bruce also resumes his life as the cowled vigilante in the form of a bat. And as he does, a series of brutal murders begin to happen in Gotham, reminiscent of the killings that suddenly stopped not long ago in London. It turns out that these murders are in fact being committed by the same killer, the infamous Jack the Ripper. Desperate to find the killer, or at least a scapegoat, the police commissioner, not Gordon, suspects Bruce is the culprit, since he was in London at the time of the Whitechapel murders that suddenly stopped when he returned to Gotham. And so Bruce is arrested and put on trial, where he is forced to find the real killer before he is hanged for crimes he did not commit. Gotham by Gaslight is a unique way to tell a Batman story. It combines compelling art with innovative storytelling techniques that manages to highlight the best aspects of Batman's character by stripping away his modern trappings and letting what is best about him come forward. It's a brilliant concept, well executed, and rightly considered one of the best Elseworld stories ever told. What did you think of this story, Brian?
Well, I'm going to let you tell us what you thought of it first, Paul.
I think I just did. I think it, like I said, I think it's a brilliant concept, taking Batman and putting him into Victorian age, 19th century. I think Batman as a character works surprisingly well for this time period. You know, I just think it's a very unique way of telling a Batman story. And I think it actually enhances the good aspects of what Batman should be. And okay. It's just a fun story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The Elseworlds experiment that DC did, I thought was interesting. There are times in which Elseworlds is used as a pejorative these days when folks are talking about occasional stories that dip into, say, particularly future, when characters are transported to the future for an alternate timeline or what have you. And then, folks are like, well, that's just an Elseworlds story, which I don't think is fair, because Elseworlds was specifically designed not to be in continuity.
Exactly. It's similar to Marvel's What If.
Right. Yeah. Minus the big bald guy. So that said, I mean, I thought that it was I enjoyed the story. It looks great. Mignola is a fantastic artist. The story, what I liked about it was Bruce Wayne / Batman as detective, which I think is missing a lot in this day and age with some of the Batman comics, which isn't a bad thing. I mean, some of the Batman comics have had some great moments, great writers, great arcs, etc. But we don't really see Batman as detective much anymore.
And yes, so I agree. I agree.
Yeah. And in some cases, he seems a bit like a moron these days, leaning a little too heavily on Jason Todd to do all the work for him. Not Jason Todd. Not Jason Todd. Jeez. Who is still alive, but not a detective. Leaning a little heavily on Tim Drake to do his detecting for him.
Yeah. It sounds like you're trying, you're robbing his title away from him.
Oh.
Robbing him of his.
I thought I'd get in there and kind of crowbar that in.
But no, I agree with you, and that's kind of why I really like this story. I'm gonna do a bit of a digression a little bit later after we talk about the story itself. But it's exactly what if you look at modern Batman right now, he's not the detective, because right. That's what he's supposed to be. He's supposed to be the best detective that's ever been.
Right.
And by And that's why I like this setting, because by taking him out of the modern age, he doesn't have computers. He doesn't have, you know, his boy wonders to go out and find the information for him. He has to detect things. And that's what I mean by when I said, you know, by stripping him of all his modern conveniences, the best of what Batman is sort of comes out.
Yes. Which is, you know, that is definitely refreshing.
So I'm taking it by your long pauses and sighs. You didn't really like this story.
Are there sighs? I'm not sighing. I'm just breathing. No, I enjoyed it a great deal. I may not have, you know, we're here. You tell, you know, well, you're telling me, yeah. But I may not have caught some of the nuances or things that you really liked about it. I may not have caught those. So, which is why we're talking about it.
Well, no,
like,
I mean,
to me, it's like I sort of felt like, were you surprised as to who Jack the Ripper turned out to be?
No, it was.
You kind
of
know from the very introduction of who Jack the Ripper turned out to be, who Jack the Ripper was going to be.
Yes, it's telegraphed right from the very beginning. You know, it's pretty. I mean, obvious.
They attempt. There is a red herring attempted.
Oh yes,
There is somebody else on. You know, it's who Jack the Ripper is somebody on the boat, and there is an attempt to sort of draw our attention to somebody else on the boat who has a sketchy past, and the attempt is to maybe make us think that that is who Jack the Ripper is going to be, but I never bought it.
No, and you know, if you take it as in today's comic book storytelling, first of all, this would have been a much more drawn out story.
Right. This is 47, 48 pages?
Yeah, I think it's 48 pages. So it's quick.
There's no decompression in this. It's a very anti-decompression story, which is great.
Right.
And kudos to it for that.
But because of that, and this is 1989, so they're rushing through these things. The subtlety of storytelling that you'd get today is not really there. But there are some really interesting storytelling techniques that they used, you know, with the old-timey newspapers coming up. You know, there actually is a film version of this, but, you know, you could see this, like, you know, remember how the newspapers used to spin up?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So you can kind of, you know, you can visualize that. I just I love the look. I love the aesthetic of it. I can't say that I'm a huge steampunk fan, but when steampunk is done well, you know, it's a fascinating genre.
No, I didn't catch much in the way of the steampunk in it. Batman's costume maybe had a little bit, but I don't even know. Did he even have goggles? Does it count as steampunk if there are no goggles?
I mean, it's not like he wasn't having a steam powered computer or anything like that. But it's just like I said in the synopsis, this was sort of the beginning of the steampunk movement,
right?
And you know that Mignola loves that aesthetic.
Yes, and you can see in his art sort of that aesthetic. You could see the sort of steampunk idea in terms of representation, but there's not the representation of the sort of steampunk technology like coming into conflict with the Victorian age like we would have in like future steampunk.
Right, right. It's not as pronounced, but it still has that idea of taking these modern concepts and sort of and putting them in just in a different genre or a different time period. And I think a lot of it more so has to do with the idea of Batman himself, the idea of Batman, the idea of his whole, and I keep saying aesthetic, but that's kind of what it is. Mm-hmm. And he like I said, he fits really well in that time period, surprisingly well.
It makes sense, particularly during that time period where this was also the time period where I believe interest in the occult was at a high, the Victorian age, and sort of so the concept of a Batman, a sort of demon looking figure, would have also been of interest and certainly play into the fears of the general public, which I think the series did try to give a nod to as well.
Absolutely, they keep referring to him as Nosferatu or a vampire or something like that.
Yeah, one of the things I really loved was James Gordon as Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, I was going to say that his look is perfect.
It's even his speech patterns. They're using you know, the speech patterns they're using is pretty great in terms of it's very much like the late 1800s, but also like how you envision Teddy Roosevelt speaking.
Yes. Bully.
Yeah, I think he says bully at least once, doesn't he?
He does.
I don't remember exactly, but I feel like he did.
But I'm actually rereading this, and I got to the James Gordon page, and I went, oh, I didn't remember Teddy Roosevelt was in this. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, wait, it's Gordon. I forgot. There's lots of little nods like that throughout the entire comic book. You know, things that we think we remember, you know, not remember, but, you know, things we think should be there. Just how people look, how they speak.
Right. We got the great passing reference to the Joker.
Yes, I did like it. Good nod. Good night. Nice to see the nod to the Joker.
Yeah. Just a one panel nod to the Joker, but there he is.
Well, I think I believe this was supposed to be a continuing storyline. So they could go on as a series.
To revisit
and come back and do the Joker. Because you see a lot of, there's like Mrs. Dent is referenced at one point.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, we'd have Two-Face at some point, and then they're doing the Joker. So it seems to me as if they could have kept coming back to this as a recurring type of Batman story.
Yeah.
Which I think would have been fascinating. I would love to see that.
It would have. I'd be curious to see how well it would be sustained.
Yeah. Let's talk about a few details in the story itself. So I guess this would be, this will be a spoilery part if anyone hasn't read this and wants to drop out, you know, bye. But there are, you know, you don't really see a lot of Batman himself.
Right. And when we do see him, he's in the shadows.
Yeah. It's very much a Bruce Wayne story. And I like that. I think that's refreshing to see the Bruce side of things and how he's dealing with, you know, how he deals with the socialites. And there's a whole trial sequence. I thought that was a very interesting way that they did the trial, which was, you know, you'd see a panel of someone given evidence against Bruce, and then you'd see a diary entry juxtaposed to that.
Right. And all done in like sort of a sepia tone.
Yes, yes. And now, again, we've kind of seen that before. You know, Jessica Jones did that sort of thing. But for 1989, that was pretty interesting, pretty innovative stuff for what was going on at the time. First of all, the story plays it up as if the commissioner, who I'm blanking on his name right now.
Is it Tolliver? It's Tolliver.
Yeah, it's Tolliver.
I think it's Tolliver.
Yeah, it's Tolliver. Is sort of, you know, he's going after Bruce just as a scapegoat. But putting together that the Whitechapel killing stopped and then when Bruce left London and then they resumed as soon as he got there, that's actually pretty good detective work.
It is.
You know, it's wrong, but because I was reading that going, you know, they're trying to imply that he's trying to set Bruce up.
Except it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. Except it's not. It's actually pretty good police work.
Yeah. Well, it's also not, he's not wrong in that the killer, Jack the Ripper, did leave Europe at the same time that Bruce Wayne did.
And arrived at the same time.
Yeah. Or arrived at the same. Yeah. So, so it was not faulty detective work. It was just missing the obvious.
Exactly. And I did like the fact, just how Jack the Ripper's psyche was portrayed, that he had snapped because, okay, so we're in spoilers.
The connection to Martha.
Martha. Martha! I wonder if Snyder read this. Why did you say that name? Yeah, so he was in love with Bruce Wayne's mother, Martha, and was trying to silence her voice that he kept hearing. He kept hearing her laugh in his head.
Well, and I think what is interesting is that, you know, that she is not presented, or Thomas probably either, is they're not presented in the best light in terms of their sort of relationship with, let's say, the lower classes.
Well, no.
And whether his memory of her rejection is faulty or not, his memory is of a rather harsh rejection based on his class. We're talking about Jack the Ripper, the character that becomes Jack the Ripper.
And, you know, and very much in keeping with this time period. Mm-hmm. This was not a, let's say, enlightened period for class or racial struggles.
No. So, unlike now, where we're doing so well.
Hey, we're making America great again, man.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but that depiction, And well, I guess that's what I was trying to say, is they're not shying away from some of the more harsher realities of what was going on. They're not trying to whitewash this thing and make it all nice.
Right.
Yeah. So it is kind of dark, but not grim dark.
Well, no, it's not. It's not the post Dark Knight, your favorite, sort of grim dark that came into play, particularly like late 80s through the 90s, through some of the 2000s.
Right up to Snyder. Snyder's still, okay. So this was what I said earlier that I was going to do a digression. And this is it. So I guess this sort of ties into what we were talking about last time. This comic proves that there are more ways than one to tell a Batman story. Typically, post Dark Knight Returns, right up until Snyder, even through the Nolan films, you see Batman as dark and moody and tortured and just so dark and moody.
He's sad.
Yes.
It's you just see Batman sitting on a park bench eating a sandwich by himself.
Exactly. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, you don't have to go 60s camp. You don't have to go completely in the other direction. But there are so many Batman stories out there where he's a detective, where he has a lighter mood. You know, the whole point of him bringing in his Robins are the fact that he gets a family and he starts seeing life in a new way.
Or he's getting a brightly colored target to distract the enemy that he's battling.
Whatever. It's still cool. But the idea is that, you know, there's just so much more to be done with this, especially in the live action, you know, the movies or in TV. We can tell so many different stories with Batman as a character. He's a great character. But I don't, just basically, can we be done with the Frank Miller grim dark aesthetic, please? Can we do something else other than Frank Miller?
No, I think we are. I think writers in recent times have. I think Grant Morrison did a good job in trying to bring him out of that, or at least adding a lot of nuance.
Well, in the comics, yes.
Yeah.
That seems to be the fallback position with a lot of writers. But there are people kind of pushing him out of that and trying to take him into new directions. But we definitely do not see it in the live-action film versions. The film versions are all, isn't he a tortured soul?
Some of the Batman films in the 90s, definitely, what's his face? The real campy version of it.
Yeah,
Schumacher's version of it, which
again,
compiled by many, but I think is kind of, I would not call it good filmmaking, but it's a hoot.
It is a hoot. But that was, what I said is we don't have to go the complete camp version, because it seems like either someone goes grimdark or campy goofy. There's a middle ground there. there's right. Something in the middle. Those are extremes. And I just love to see Affleck's Batman. I don't know if you've seen. Have you seen Justice League or
Batman? I have not yet.
He's so emotionally stunted and sad. Well, Batman can smile. He can do that. That's why he leaves the whole mouth part open.
Yeah. I thought it was for breathing.
No, it's for a bright, sunshiny smile. That's why he wears yellow on the back.
The yellow's coming back.
His heart is bright.
Yes, yes. Bruce Wayne's heart is bright.
Yes. There's just a lot to be done with Batman.
Well, I think one of the reasons that they do this with Batman, I think, is the Trinity. I mean, we're basically talking the Trinity. You have Superman, you have Batman, you have Wonder Woman, and they're representing sort of I'm not going to go religious Trinity on it, but they're Trinity representing, if Superman is the bright light,
then Batman has to be the dark.
Then Batman, if you're going to present it in that sort of dichotomy, the Batman has to be the darkness. And well, I'm not saying that that is how it should be, but I am saying that is, I think, how with the advent of viewing Wonder Woman, Batman, and Superman as the Trinity, the concept of them as a Trinity is a full discussion at another point, or over hours. But I think that's where I think that's part of the origin of why it persists to this day, particularly in the films, I think.
Well, I think that,
And again, we don't have to go into the intricacies of threes.
No. I think what's missing for me in that, just exactly what you were talking about, is you have Superman, who is the unbeatable alien, indestructible. Well, Batman's not that. He's a human, and he has to use his wits, his ingenuity, to do the same things that Superman does. And that's a fascinating aspect. And it gets back to his detective skills as well.
Right.
It's his intellect that is the most fascinating part to me about Batman.
It's why the Batman always wins hashtag was such a big thing for a while. It's a silly hashtag, but it was certainly a thing for a good while.
And I think, you know, how the best Batman stories, again, for me, are when he's being smart, not when he's beating people up or using grappling hooks or whatever. That's cool. But the best aspects of that character is when he's being smart.
Right. Or when he's one step ahead.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'd love to see that. You know, I'd love to see it in the comics, and I'd love to see it. I'd really love to see it in the films.
Well, good luck with seeing it in the films.
Well, hopefully this last round of disappointment will maybe push the writers and the filmmakers. Because, you know, Wonder Woman, incredibly hopeful and smart, and that did really well. Justice yes. League, kind of down and depressing, did not do well.
Nope.
Maybe the audiences want hopeful and smart.
Well, and, you know, ideally when Bendis gets tired of writing Superman and takes over Batman, you will see that bright, shiny, cheerful Batman that you want.
I don't know. His Daredevil.
Is that not sarcastic enough?
Yeah. His Daredevil was pretty down.
Well, yeah. That's Bendis. If Bendis ever writes Batman, he's not going to write a happy Batman.
Hashtag happy Batman.
Happy Batman. There you go. Hashtag happy Batman. Go ahead and get that started on your social media, Paul.
Okay. So let's talk about the art real quick.
Okay.
Now, Mignola has a very unique style. And you can, you know, it's not as pronounced as it will later be in his Hellboy years. But you can definitely see how his style is evolving in this story. How would you describe Mignola's artwork? Because it's very, very unique.
I was not prepared to try to describe Mignola's artwork.
Well, later in Hellboy and some of his other works, you get to see, you know, the big hands and
right.
And the
well, there's an there's definitely exaggeration and to everything. It's also very kind of, you were just talking about not wanting dark Batman, but Mignola's art is kind of gritty. It's a little dirty looking, intentionally. There's with sort of the blurry lines as opposed to very defined lines on both his characters and in his landscaping.
Yeah, and when I say, you know, dark Batman, I'm talking more about tone.
Thematically,
thematically. Not necessarily the artwork. Because he's a guy dressed up as a bat. I mean, you know, the dark in the shadows thing visually works really well, especially in this time period, which is all by gaslight.
Right.
So you get
and
that
this is,
smoky.
You know, this is, and to be clear, this isn't, you know, hashtag happy Batman.
Oh, no.
In Gotham by Gaslight either. And his use of shadows, his use of his presentation of Gotham as sort of London. There's a, you see the, particularly some scenes where the character who turns out to be Jack the Ripper is scoping out the ladies of the night to determine who his next victim will be. You get that sort of, the sort of, well, gothic horror tones to Mignola's art, and definitely makes you one think of the depictions of London at the time as well.
Oh yeah. And yes, there, you know, Gotham is definitely a European looking town, or at least a colonial looking town.
Yeah.
In the artwork, that's how it's depicted. And, you know, and that's, there's definitely a mood that he's trying to evoke, a look that he's trying to emulate, and that completely works with this story.
No, oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's very I love the whole look of this comic, and it's interesting to me, at least from a historical perspective, to see where he was at this time and where he will go soon. Because when did Hellboy start?
Oh, geez,
I'd say mid-90s, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, not long after this. If it wasn't already going,
I don't think it was going at this point.
Character first appeared in San Diego Comic-Con comics in August 1993. Was his first appearance in a regularly published title.
So, yeah, so not very much longer after this. Yeah, and you can definitely see that style that he will translate into those Hellboy stories. Because there's definitely, and I'm going to say it again, aesthetic that he really likes. That old, you know, the merging of new and old.
Right.
Well, you know, it's kind got of supernatural classic things over top of it. Yeah.
It's got the kind of classic sort of illustration. It's got the classic Mignola is the perfect person to illustrate a Victorian age comic.
Yeah, exactly.
And you see it like, the illustrations of the time, which he definitely are definitely influences on his current work.
Oh, absolutely. And like I said, the steampunk as a subgenre was just starting at this time. You know, steampunk, the term steampunk was coined in 1987, I think it was. So what defined what steampunk is was just growing at this point, and it would be taken off in a new direction. And, I guess I should clarify. Steampunk, there's lots of people who say that it's been around for a long time. Look at something like Wild Wild West in the 60s.
One of my favorite TV shows of all time.
So that could be considered steampunk.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah. But H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, they're pioneers. But it wasn't a specific genre or even recognized as such until the 80s. So, right. I mean, now it's such a huge thing that people are very eager to retroactively go back and scoop up anything that's remotely resembling it and call it steampunk. But Wild Wild West was a very unique thing. And
yes.
As far as Wells and Verne, they weren't doing steampunk. They were just creating sci-fi.
They were imagining what something would look like in the future with the limited technological knowledge they had at the time.
Yes, yes. They were writing science fiction specific to their time. So yeah, so this was a new genre. It's kind of old hat now, old top hat, basically.
Hey!
Hey! But Mignola was definitely a pioneer in that artwork and that style.
Yes.
Again, I love the look of this thing. I think it still stands up today. So there is a film version, an animated version of this comic. That's pretty recent, came out last year, I believe.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I did not know this.
They change quite a bit. I mean, it's pretty close to the style of the comic, but you know, it's animation, so they can't be 100% Mignola's look. They do the best they can. Yeah, they try to do the best they can, but they've changed. The killer's different.
Okay.
And the setting of it kind of takes place more of on the Chicago World Fair kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Like Devil in the White City.
Exactly. So it's good. It's interesting. I'm not a huge fan of that, of the direct-to-DVD animation movies that DC puts out every once in a while.
Some of them work out well. I've seen a few that I enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely better than Marvel's by far. But for what it is, it's good.
Well, I'll have to hunt that down.
I guess in conclusion, I really enjoy this story on its own merits. Like I said in the synopsis, I think it's a brilliant concept, and it works extremely well for Batman. Batman just fits in 1889. I'd like to see more of it. That steampunk aesthetic suits him really well. And I wish more was done with this concept, but because the possibilities for unique and unusual stories about Batman are right there, and they're abundant.
I know.
But as a one-shot, a one-and-done story, I definitely think this is worth your time. And you
I enjoyed it greatly as well.
Okay. Well, that does it for Gotham by Gaslight. Brian, next time on an all-new collected edition, do you have a recommendation?
I do. I do indeed. And this might end up being kind of a fun one, or not. For our next episode of Collected Edition, we will be talking about Animal Man, particularly issues 18 through 26 of the late 80s, early 90s run of Animal Man by Grant Morrison. This is his final story arc on his rather infamous Animal Man run, and I shall leave it at that. We will be discussing, so essentially, to be succinct, we'll be discussing Animal Man, issues 18 through 26, and it will be Grant Morrison's run.
Okay, that should be very interesting. We can be podcasters that are aware that we're on a podcast.
Yes, we could.
Yeah, so that's kind of a classic run of Animal Man, which probably it's definitely what brought him back to prominence.
Well, it brought Animal Man back, and of course it was his work on Animal Man and Doom Patrol both at this time, and Arkham Asylum, I believe, came out at the same time that sort of rocketed Grant Morrison into whatever rarefied stratosphere he is currently regarded in. And this run in particular features a few things that have been used since, I say too much. We shall talk about it in 2 weeks.
Yes, this will be a lot of fun. So that's it for this episode of the Collected Edition. Thanks for listening, everyone. And remember, you can always leave us a comment on the website, collectededitionpodcast.com, or hit us up at Twitter at @CollectedEdPod, or comments at collectededitionpodcast.com if you want to send us an email the old-fashioned way. We'd really love to hear from you and hear what you have to say and get your feedback and all that. And if you're so inclined, leave us a review on iTunes, because that really helps us get found and bring on more listeners. So again, thank you for listening, and until next time, just keep reading comics.
Be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the #CollectedEdition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only. Are you not-